Hello, this is Paula with the Vermilion County News on Thursday, October 11th, 2018. We'll start with a story titled District 118 Eyes Substitute Pay Increase, and this is written by Carol Rome in Danville. The Danville District 118 School Board Wednesday night discussed the need to increase the pay for substitute teachers and other substitute personnel so the district can be competitive. Kimberly Papps, Assistant Director of Human Resources, proposed increasing the substitute teacher pay to $125 a day from $95 a day, and District 118 retired substitute teacher pay to $135 a day from $105 a day. Papps also recommended increasing substitute teaching assistant pay to $85 a day from $65, and substitute secretary pay to $85 a day from $75. All four categories of substitutes would receive a $10 a day bonus after 30 days of subbing in the district. Papps said substitute teacher pay at other school districts in Champaign and Vermilion counties range from $85 a day at Salt Fork to $125 a day in Urbana. Because of the national teacher shortage, 20 substitute teachers are teaching classrooms in the district. There have been some instances when deans, principals, and assistant principals have had to substitute in classrooms, Papps said. The board is expected to vote on the recommendation at a later meeting. Also on Wednesday, the board heard from District 118 parent Terry Davis, who asked the board to consider beefing up security and installing metal detectors at all of the doors at Danville High School. A few weeks ago, there was a noise that caused a lockdown at the high school, she said, referring to an incident in which a couple of students shot off fireworks in the hallway. It's no secret our community is in trouble, Davis said. These children are doing things we can't even comprehend. Davis said she asked the board several years ago to consider installing metal detectors, but was met with an incredulous look. This time, she said, I'm asking the board to not look past me and to be proactive. She said she wants the board and administration to come up with a strategic plan to implement metal detectors. Davis said she's concerned some troubled teens don't want to come and talk to you and could easily bring a weapon to school. Superintendent Alicia Geddes told the board that she has met with Davis about the issue and that her previous district in South Suburban Dalton installed metal detectors during her tenure. Geddes, however, outlined a few issues with installing metal detectors at DHS. DHS has at least 27 doors, possibly more, she said. It's a real threat when you have so many doors, she said, adding, at DHC, we have a problem with students and staff propping doors open. The high school also has a shortage of hall monitors right now. Who's going to man the doors when we have trouble monitoring the halls now, Geddes said. Board member Lon Henderson said the district could consider going to a clear backpack policy similar to what is enforced at Decatur Public Schools and the University of Illinois. Geddes suggested the board members and Davis visit some of the public schools that have metal detectors to see whether they are effective. Okay, the next story is titled Busier Days Ahead. Danville Election Office Expects More Traffic Soon. And this is written by Jennifer Bailey in Danville. And there is a picture of Election Commission Executive Director Sandy Delhay sits in the early voting area for the November 6th election in the basement outside the commission's office in the Vermilion County Administrative Building, which is the former federal courthouse. Now that it's official, Mayor Scott Eisenhower will be leaving the office November 4th to become Rantoul's new village administrator. Danville Election Commission Executive Director Sandy Delhay expects her office to get busier. Another factor playing a part in the mayor's position is whether the city referendum to change to a city manager form of government passes on November 6th. If it passes by a majority vote, that means the city's mayor position would go from full-time to part-time. They just don't know, Delhay said, about candidates for the mayor position. So far, only 12 people have picked up election packets to run next year for city positions. In addition to the mayor's position, the city treasurer and half of the city council, 7 aldermen with one in each ward, will be up for election. City candidates don't officially file to run for office and be on the ballot until November 19th through the 26th. The primary election if needed next year would be February 26th. The consolidation general election is April 2nd. Those who have picked up packets so far for Mayor resident Donald E. Cruz Jr. and Ward 7 Alderman Lloyd Randall, for City Treasurer incumbent Treasurer Stephanie Wilson, for Ward 1 Alderman resident Jim Foley and Ward 1 Alderwoman Brenda Brown, for Ward 2 Alderman resident Jerry Hocker and Ward 2 Alderman Rick Strebing, for Ward 3 Alderman, Ward 3 Alderwoman Sharon Pickering, for Ward 5 Alderman, Ward 5 Alderman Tom Stone, for Ward 6 Alderman, residents Tom Pruitt and Aaron Troglia, and Ward 6 Alderman John Cooper, and for Ward 7 Alderman Randall. In Ward 4, Alderman Michael Kane said he also plans to seek re-election. Packets can be picked up at the Danville Election Commission's office, new office in the Vermilion County Administration Building, the former federal courthouse at 201 North Vermilion Street. The office is in the basement with a handicapped accessible ramp in the back of the building. Office hours are from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Signatures needed of registered voters to run for each office are as follows. For mayor and treasurer, based on a 5,543 votes in the last election, 277 minimum and 443 maximum. Ward 1 alderman, based on 532 votes in the last election, 27 minimum and 43 maximum. Ward 2, based on 566 votes, 29 minimum and 46 maximum. Ward 3, based on 480 votes, 24 minimum and 39 maximum. Ward 4 alderman, based on 351 votes, 18 minimum and 29 maximum. Ward 4 alderman, based on 351 votes, 18 minimum and 29 maximum. Ward 5 with 946 votes, 48 minimum, 76 maximum. Ward 6, based on 1,067 votes, 54 minimum and 86 maximum. And in Ward 7, based on 1,602 votes, 81 minimum and 129 maximum. Okay, the next story is titled Truman to Recreate Visit to Danville. Bands, cars, speeches take people back to 1948. And this is written by Mary Wyckoff in Danville. Those who attended the rally in 1948 when President Harry Truman stopped in Danville can pick up a ribbon Sunday saying, "I was there in 48." The paper ribbons and buttons will be available Sunday at the Truman Whistle Stop 1948, which reenacts the president's campaign stop. The festivities will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday on the grassy lot on the north side of Main Street, 2 to 300 block, next to the railroad tracks where a plaque marking Abraham Lincoln's last stop is located. People may park on the Jackson Street. Visitors are invited to dress up in the 1940s clothing. The gathering will mark 70 years since the president's visit, with a reenactment of the original event, including a portrayal of Truman, a replica of platform from the Ferdinand Magellan train car, 1940s cars, music, and band. The event is part of the Illinois Bicentennial, presented by Illinois Humanities and the Vermilion County Museum Society. Andrew Peters with DLO Musical Theater will portray Truman, and Nancy Henderson will portray Bess. Danville Mayor Scott Eisenhower will stand in as the mayor at that time. Girth Hicks and State Senator Scott Bennett will serve as the Democratic Senator from that time. After Truman's speech, Sam Rushe, archivist with the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum, and Tim Smith, local historian, will conduct a roundtable discussion pertaining to the political history of Danville and its significance in the 1948 campaign. At 3 p.m., sixth grader winners in a postcard contest will be acknowledged, as well as Danville Area Community College students who placed in a poster contest. The public will choose first, second, and third place winners for the poster contest. Sue Richter, director of the Vermilion County Museum, said the museum has been receiving calls from people who were at the event in 1948 as children or young adults. Those people who attend the event will be acknowledged. They should go to the check-in table to receive a paper ribbon, which can be attached to a Truman button. About 200 buttons will be available. A brass band put together by Brass Inferno Productions from Chicago will perform, and antique cars will help at the scene if the weather cooperates. Students from the Culinary Arts Department at DACC will provide refreshments from that time period, including individual apple pies, assorted cupcakes, cream puffs, and coffee. People are urged to bring lawn chairs or blankets to sit and listen to the political speech. A tent will be set up. Also, posters will be available so people can cheer along with the president. The original stop saw an estimated crowd of 6,007,000 gathered to Truman Rail on Congress, saying all it did was pass laws favoring the big lobbies, railroads, and special interests. He made a bid for the farm vote at the time in a speech that was also broadcast on WDAN. Danville was just one stop on a 30,000-mile tour that many attribute to Truman's unexpected reelection. Dewey was so favored to win that predictions were still going his way late into election night, and culminated with the infamous Dewey Defeats Truman headline in the Chicago Daily Tribune. Truman would make one more stop in Danville in November of 1952, appearing before a smaller crowd. Students contest. The DACC students who submitted entries for the poster contest are Aliyah Dawson, Detavis Derrickson, Anastasia Fitzsimmons, Isaiah England, Trinity Fitzsimmons, Hannah Glascott, Jordan Hardy, Alexis LeBourne, and Megan Roberts. They are students in Ronald S. Johnson's class. Sixth grade students taking first place in the postcard contest were Natalie Spencer from Armstrong Elementary School, Adriana Romero from Southview School, Madeline Ingram from Southview School, and Hunter Hackett from First Baptist Christian Church. Okay, the next one is Fairmount Man Dies in a Crash. And it's just a staff reporter in Danville. A Fairmount man died in a collision Tuesday in rural Vermilion County. J.A. Hageman, 66, was pronounced dead at the scene about 4:50 p.m. after his tractor was hit by a vehicle on a rural road between Seidel and Allerton. The other driver, Austin A. Ricard, 29 of Homer, was taken to Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, where he was treated and released. Illinois State Police said the international truck tractor grain hauler driven by Hageman was traveling south on County Road 250 East, and a 2002 Chevrolet Suburban driven by Ricard was traveling east on County Road 300 North. The tractor failed to stop at the stop sign and hit the Suburban as it went through the intersection. Upon the collision, both vehicles ran off the roadway into the ditch on the southeast corner of the intersection. No charges were filed. Okay, we'll run through the obituaries. Evelyn Babe Jane Rice, 97, of Urbana, formerly of Potomac, passed away at 1:20 a.m. on Sunday, October 7th, at Clark Lindsay Village in Urbana. A celebration of Evelyn's life will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, October 12th, at Middle Fork United Methodist Church in Potomac, with Pastor George Desmond officiating. She will be laid to rest following the services in the Potomac Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Middle Fork United Methodist Church or Potomac Public Library. Terry Cobbs Bolden, a.k.a. Shy, 63, of Las Vegas, Nevada, formerly of Danville, passed away on September 28th at his residence. A visitation will commence from 11 to noon on Saturday, October 13th, at Leek & Sons Funeral Home at 304 East William Street in Danville. A memorial service will follow. Jack Dean Grubb, 85, of Covington, Indiana, passed away at 9:51 a.m. EDT time on Tuesday, October 9th at his residence. Funeral services at 2 p.m. EDT time Thursday, October 11th at Diverter Funeral Home in Cayuga, Indiana. Officiating, Pastor Bob Fairchild. Burial, Lower Mound Cemetery, north of Perryville, Indiana. Visitation, noon EDT time Thursday, October 11th until time of the services at the funeral home. Contributions may be made to Perryville United Methodist Church or to the Fountain County Animal Shelter. Earl Millard Jones, 94, of Danville, passed away at 1:05 p.m. Sunday, October 7th at Garden View Manor. A celebration of Earl's life will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, October 13th at Hope United Church of Christ with Pastor Frank Haas officiating. He will be laid to rest following the services in Embry Cemetery with military rites conducted by the Potomac American Legion. Visitation will be at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday at the church. Memorials may be made to the UAW Local 579. Paul Tevabaugh passed away peacefully at 2:50 p.m. Tuesday, October 9th, at home surrounded by his family. There will be a private family graveside service at 2 p.m. October 12th at Resurrection Cemetery. A celebration of life will be at 6 p.m. October 12th at Sarge's Tap at 408 East Main Street in Danville for all the family and friends. Ethel Et May Bassoloni, 96 of Westville, passed away at 9:30 p.m. on Sunday, October 7th at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana with her nieces by her side. A celebration of Et's life will be at 7 p.m. Thursday, October 11th at Sunset Urbis Funeral Chapel at 414 South State Street in Westville with Pastor James Blue officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday prior to her service at the funeral home. And Gregory Dean Thornsboro, a longtime resident of Westville, died suddenly October 4th at the age of 70. A celebration of Greg's life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, October 12th at Sunset Urbis Funeral Chapel at 414 South State Street in Westville and will be officiated by Greg's cousin, Reverend Bruce Thornsboro of West Lebanon Christian Church of Lebanon, West Lebanon, Indiana. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 a.m. Friday prior to the service at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in Sunset Memorial Park with an additional prayer service given by Reverend Thornsboro and Reverend Michael Kontos of Three Hierarchies Greek Orthodox Church of Champaign officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made in Greg's name for his brother's continuing care or to the American Diabetes Association or the American Heart Association. Well, there's not a lot of local news today, so we'll go to some national news about the hurricane. This is written by Jay Reeves and Brenda Farrington from the Associated Press titled Hurricane Michael Slams into Florida. And there is a picture of a beachgoer takes a photo of the waves Wednesday on Okaloosa Island in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, behind the boardwalk as Hurricane Michael comes ashore. The storm had winds of 155 miles per hour. Supercharged by abnormally warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico, Hurricane Michael slammed into the Florida panhandle with terrifying winds of 155 miles per hour Wednesday, splintering homes and submerging neighborhoods. It was the most powerful hurricane to hit the continental United States in nearly 50 years. Its winds shrieking, Michael crashed ashore in the early afternoon near Mexico Beach, a tourist town about midway along the panhandle, a lightly populated 200-mile stretch of white sand beach resorts, fishing towns, and military bases. It battered the coastline with sideways rain, powerful gusts, and crashing waves. It swamped streets and docks, flattened trees, stripped away limbs and leaves, knocked out power to 250,000 homes and businesses, shredded awnings, and sent shingles flying. Explosions apparently caused by blown transformers could be heard. We are catching some hail, said Timothy Thompson, Thomas, who rode out the storm with his wife in their second-floor apartment in Panama City Beach. He said he could see broken street signs and a 90-foot pine bent at a 45-degree angle. In Mexico Beach, population 1,000, the storm shattered homes, leaving floating piles of lumber. The lead-gray water was so high that roofs were about all that could be seen from many homes. Michael was a meteorological brute that sprang quickly from a weekend tropical depression, becoming a fearsome Category 4 by early Wednesday, up from a Category 2 less than a day earlier. It was the most powerful hurricane on record to hit the panhandle. I've had to take antacids. I'm so sick to my stomach today because of the impending catastrophe, National Hurricane Center scientist Eric Blake tweeted as the storm, drawing energy from the unusually warm 84-degree Gulf waters, became more menacing. More than 375,000 people up and down the Gulf Coast were urged to evacuate as Michael closed in. But the fast-moving storm didn't give people much time to prepare, and emergency authorities lamented that many ignored the warnings and seemed to think they could ride it out. While it might be their constitutional right to be an idiot, it's not their right to endanger everyone else, Walton County Sheriff Michael Atkinson tweeted. Diane Ferris, 57, and her son walked to a high school turned shelter near their home in Panama City to find about 1,100 people crammed into a space meant for about half as many. Neither she nor her son had any way to communicate because their cell phone got wet and quit working. I'm worried about my daughter and grandbaby. I don't know where they are, you know. That's really hard, she said, choking back tears. Hurricane force winds extended up to 45 miles, 75 kilometers from Michael's center. Forecasters said rainfall could reach up to a foot or 30 centimeters, and the life-threatening storm surge could swell to 14 feet or 4 meters. A water level station in Appalachia, close to where Michael rolled ashore, reported a surge of nearly 8 feet or 2.5 meters. Based on its internal barometric pressure, Michael was the third most powerful hurricane to blow ashore on the U.S. mainland, behind the unnamed Labor Day storm of 1935 and Camille in 1969. Based on wind speed, it was the fourth strongest, behind the Labor Day storm of 184 miles per hour and Camille and Andrew in 1992. It appeared to be so powerful that it was expected to remain a hurricane as it moves into Alabama and Georgia early Thursday. Forecasters said it will unleash damaging wind and rain all the way into the Carolinas, still recovering from Hurricane Florence's epic flooding. At the White House, President Donald Trump said the government is absolutely ready for the storm. God bless everyone, because it's going to be a rough one, he said, a very dangerous one. In Panama City, plywood and metal flew off of the front of a Holiday Inn Express. Part of the awning fell and shattered the glass front door at the hotel, and the rest of the awning wound up on vehicles parked below it. Oh my God, what are we doing, said evacuee Rachel Franklin, her mouth hanging open. The hotel swimming pool had white caps and people's ears popped because of the drop in barometric pressure. The roar of the hurricane sounded like an airplane taking off. Meteorologists watched satellite imagery in complete awe as the storm infested. We are in a new territory, National Hurricane Center meteorologist Dennis Feltgen wrote on Facebook. The historical record going back to 1851 finds no Category 4 hurricane ever hitting the Florida panhandle. Colorado State University hurricane expert Phil Klotzbach said in an email, I really fear for what things are going to look like here when it's done tomorrow. The storm is likely to fire up the debate over global warming. Scientists say global warming is responsible for more intense and more frequent extreme weather, such as storms, droughts, floods, and fires. But without extensive study, they cannot directly link a single weather event to the changing climate. With Election Day less than a month away, the crisis was seen as a test of leadership for Scott, a Republican running for the Senate, and Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, the Democrat nominee for governor. Just as northern politicians are judged on how they handle snowstorms, their southern counterparts are watched closely on how they deal with hurricanes. More than 5,000 evacuees sought shelter in Tallahassee, which is about 25 miles from the coast, but is covered by live oak and pine trees that can fall and cause power outages even in smaller storms. Only a skeleton staff remained at Tyndall Air Force Base, situated on the peninsula just south of Panama City, the home of the 325th Fighter Wing, and some 600 military families appeared squarely targeted for the worst of the storm's fury, and leaders declared HurCon 1 status, ordering out all but essential personnel. The base's aircraft, which include F-22 Raptors, were flown hundreds of miles away as a precaution. Forecasters predicted 9 to 14 feet of water at Tyndall. In St. Mark's, John Hargan said, and his family gathered up their pets and moved to a raised building constructed to withstand a Category 5 after water from the St. Mark's River began surrounding their home. Hargan's 11-year-old son, Jaden, carried one of the family's dogs in a laundry basket in one arm and held a skateboard in the other as he waded through calf-high water. Hargan, a bartender at a riverfront restaurant, feared he would lose his home and his job to the storm. "We basically just walked away from everything and said goodbye to it," he said, tears welling up. "I'm freaking scared I'm going to lose everything I own, man." One more here. Rare cases of nervous system disorder being reported, and this is in Chicago. The Illinois Department of Public Health announced Wednesday that health care providers in the state have reported 9 clinically diagnosed cases of a rare condition that afflicts the nervous system, in particular the spinal cord. The condition is called acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, which attacks the nervous system and can lead to arm or leg weakness and loss of muscle reflexes. It has received increased attention in recent weeks after health officials in Minnesota and Colorado saw spikes in reported cases, Illinois Public Health Department spokeswoman Melanie Arnold said. The reported Illinois cases are preliminary diagnoses and only the U.S. Centers for Disease Control can confirm the diagnosis, according to Arnold. Until then, doctors are treating the cases as if they are AFM. The CDC has indicated there might be some increases in cases, and in mid-September, we advised health care officials to be vigilant and report to the health department so that we can pass the information on to the CDC, Arnold said. Between August of 2014 and August of 2018, the CDC received information on a total of 362 confirmed cases of AFM nationwide. According to the CDC, the largest number of cases, about 50, were reported in September of 2014 before dropping to single digits in the following months. The number again spiked to about 45 in September of 2016. There were about 15 cases reported in August of 2018. If Dr. Tina Tan, who specializes in infectious diseases and has attended to Julia, said the best advice to parents is to be vigilant and take note of concerning symptoms. If their child gets an intraviral infection, they need to look for symptoms such as sudden onset of arm and leg weakness, difficulty in swallowing, and sometimes slurring of the speech, Tan said. And just real quick, in Danville, the Haunted Happenings event that was to take place on October 27th at Harrison Park Golf Course has been canceled due to a lack of volunteers. And there's a church, Greater Shiloh Baptist Church on Bowman Avenue, will be serving pulled pork butt and catfish dinners from 11 to 5 on Friday. The cost will be $10. A bake sale is also planned. Delivery will be available and carry out. Call 446-5502. So that'll be it for today, Thursday, October 11th, 2018. Got a little cold out there, so try to keep warm. And hopefully you have a good week, and I'll see you again next week. Take care. Thanks for listening. Bye.